Hello, welcome everybody to the No Normal Show for Thursday, October 8, 2020, brought to you by Revive Health. This is our weekly deep dive in how hospital and health system marketers can navigate what we call the no normal. I am Chris Bevelo, Health Systems Practice Lead at Revive Health and your host for the show. I am joined by Chase Kleckner, who is Senior Marketing Manager at Revive Health and our show's producer. Hello, Chase.
Hi, Chris. Good to see you as always.
Good to see you too. Also good to see back with us, Jarrett Lewis. Jarrett is a partner at Public Opinion Strategies, a national survey research firm based in Alexandria, Virginia. Jarrett is focused specifically in the healthcare industry. And prior to joining Public Opinion Strategies, he spent nearly a decade at the Health Management Academy, most recently running the health policy practice, and before that, running the firm's internal consumer research division. Hello, Jarrett.
Chris, hey, how are you? Good to be here with you.
I'm very good. We're so glad you're here. We can't wait to dive in. Let me get through some notes quick, and then we will dive into politics and polling and surveys and all kinds of great stuff. So just some quick notes. If you're new to the show, on this podcast, we share industry trends, research, stories from those both within and from outside the industry, in ideas, content, all kinds of things to help health system marketers navigate what we call the no normal successfully. If you want to understand more about what we mean by the no normal, key principles of it, check out our blog post, which Chase will share in the chat function. Speaking of the chat function, you can use that to talk to other attendees. Chase will also be using it to post links to things that we're talking about. But if you want a question, or if you want us to answer a question, if you've got one for Jason or for Jarrett, for myself, or for Chase, make sure that goes in the Q&A function of Zoom. So not in the chat function. We watch for the Q&A queue for questions. So make sure you put it there. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll also be, as always, posting a video recording of the episode on our website by the end of the afternoon. You can find that at thinkrevivehealth.com/COVID-19. All right, Chase, every time we do the notes, we're getting better and better at getting through those things super quick, which is awesome. You're that was a record 2 minutes.
That was pretty good.
It is good. And now I just blew it by talking about how fast we were and adding another minute. But that just gives us more time to get into the content of the show and what Jarrett is here to talk about. So, boy, there's a lot to talk about. When we had our prep meeting, Jarrett, for this, that was last week, and we were just kind of all picking our jaws up off the ground, talking about all the things that had happened in the prior, you know, 10 days from RBG passing to the tax story in the New York Times. Now I can't even remember all the things that happened, to the debate, to the president getting COVID. Now I guess we can throw in the VP debate from last night. So many things. So let's just start with just broadly speaking, what you're seeing in terms of the race, and then we'll talk about the implications of that in various ways on healthcare, and then more specifically hospitals and health systems. So where are we at? What are you seeing?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thanks again for having me. Both you and Chase, really enjoy the opportunity to be with you both, and looking forward to the discussion. In terms of, and just a little bit context, you mentioned I specifically focus in the healthcare industry. I also have 8 or 9 partners who work in the campaign space. And so from congressional to Senate to gubernatorial to state led, so I get to sort of live vicariously through them and have a really good pulse on what's going on around the country. And so that talking through that lens on the state of the race. But, you know, it's interesting, Chris, the more things have changed this year, the more they've stayed the same. And what I mean is, if you look at the ballot between Joe Biden and Donald Trump on January 1, it was 50-43 in favor of the former vice president in favor of Joe Biden. Today, it is 51-42. So a 2-point shift and you look back and think about all of the things that have happened in the course of the last 10 months between COVID, between the conversation around racial and social injustice that stemmed from the George Floyd murder, and you know, so many things, Ruth Bader Ginsburg a few weeks ago, now we're in the debates, and you have presidential campaigns themselves always take up an enormous amount of oxygen, but we've had two, I think, generational events happen that in addition to a presidential campaign this year. And so, so many things have happened around the country. I think so many things have happened that have affected a lot of your clients, you know, looking at your clients in California and dealing with the wildflowers, fires, and just so many things. And, but yet the race is essentially where we were at the beginning of the year. And I think that's interesting. I think what it does is it sort of underscores how few swing and movable voters there are in today's sort of hyper-polarized environment. I think you look back 20, 30, 40 years ago when there were more voters that crossed over, you know, would go from one party to the other in an election. And now we're sort of red team, blue team, and there's not a lot of purple team out there. And so I'll leave that comment aside of what that means for society, but I think it's sort of very indicative of that kind of point. You look, you know, nationally at the race, and of course we don't run a national election, but the former vice president has had a very consistent lead going back to the summer of 2019. He's had between a 7 and 10 point lead in the average of polling in the Real Clear Politics average. And I'll talk about lessons learned from 2016 in a little bit, yeah. But it's a much different environment than 16. And then when you look at the states, because obviously we run a electoral college system, the Joe Biden is sitting right around 49-50 in kind of the key states like Florida, like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. And that's a good place for a challenger to be and a not so good place for the incumbent to be in. So he's in a pretty steady position and has kind of had a consistent consistency about his ballot performance over the last few months and this year.
So talk a little bit about, I think more recently, and I mean in the last week, I would say post-debate, you've seen some of those numbers, or you've seen polling quoted, like I think CNN's poll was the first one to come out that showed like a 16 point lead. So talk to us a little bit about how, you know, like you shared before the show, what did you call it? Like a sugar high. Some of that's like, you're going to see it kind of elevate, but it's not likely to stay there.
Yeah, it's exactly right. We actually, so our firm does the work for NBC Wall Street Journal, and we came out of the field we did a 2-night survey right after the debate, national survey, pre the hospitalization. So we came out, I think, on last Friday or Saturday with the data. And we had the vice president, former vice president, up by, I think, 13 or 14. I think there's a little bit of a sugar high. I think between the New York Times story, between the debate, which voters were, and we actually did some focus groups that one of my partners went on Meet the Press on Sunday to talk about. Voters were not happy with either candidate's performance, but they were less satisfied, I think, or more dissatisfied with the president's performance at the debate. And so I think it all kind of impacted him. And now you're sort of seeing some of the effects of being, testing positive with COVID and the hospitalization. But I think there is a little bit of a sugar high in some of these polls, like the NBC Wall Street Journal, like the CNN one, that I think we kind of come back down to, where we've been, which is around Biden plus 8, Biden plus 9, Biden plus 7. It's not very realistic to think that Joe Biden's going to win the popular vote by 13 or 12 points. But I think that's sort of what has happened over the last week. And even if it's a sugar high, if you're the Trump campaign, you look at that and you're like, we've got a ways to go to try to climb back into being competitive in this race.
But just a couple more quick things before we get to healthcare specifically. I know we want to talk about a little more, I think, polling now in 2016. But have you got any data now that reflects what happened with the president with his COVID situation? I know that's really fresh, but he's still dealing with it, I think, from what we can see or tell, not from hearing him directly, but that's such an interesting situation again, where you could see it moving it either way, but because of the, like you said, kind of the red team, blue team, wouldn't expect it to go big either way.
if you look at some of the groups that the president is sort of underperforming where he was in 2016, two that stand out in my mind are women and, or I should say white women and seniors. And those are, you know, women have shown more concern over the coronavirus than men have, going back to when the pandemic first began back in March, at least in the US. And, you know, seniors have expressed more concern than other age groups about, you know, testing positive and contracting the virus. And so I think all of that sort of, there was conversation about maybe he gets a little bit of a sympathy vote. I don't think that's playing out. I think it's more, if it's having any impact, it's having a little bit of a negative impact on, I think, his candidacy. And I think that's why you've seen such a quick return to the White House, and kind of he's kind of returning to sort of normal President Trump kind of style. And so I think that's why you're seeing those that sort of quick return, because there wasn't a boost from you know, having and being hospitalized. I don't think it has a huge effect either way. I do think for voters that care about, you know, if that's their top issue, it certainly weakens him with those voters. But for voters who care about the economy or immigration or other issues, I don't think it has much of an impact. So I'd say net kind of maybe a little bit negative, but overall, you know, it happened so fast over the weekend. If it was a prolonged stay, it might be a different story, but I think it's sort of, we are where we were post debate.
Okay. And then the last thing, you mentioned this before, talk to us a little bit, because obviously there was a lot of controversy in 2016 about polling overall, a lot of polls being off or perceived to be off. I don't remember exactly, but I think in 2016, right up until the election, not this far out, you know, Hillary Clinton had a lead. I don't know if it was like 3 or 4 points. But a lot of conversation afterwards about how the polls were wrong. Speak a little bit about whether that's actually a fair perception, and how things are the same or different, and how we're trying to make sure that's not the case this time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's truth on both sides. I think there are definitely things that the polling industry miscalculated in 2016. I think a couple things happened in 2016 when you look back. I think there was an element of disbelief that, not necessarily to say Donald Trump himself could be president, but that you had this huge Republican primary field with what was called kind of the deepest bench in Republican, you know, presidential primary history, with Jeb Bush and Chris Christie and Marco Rubio. And then you had sort of this air of almost inevitability with you know, Secretary Clinton, of at least she was going to be the nominee. And if you recall back, it came a little bit closer than I think people anticipated with Bernie Sanders, but there was sort of an inevitability that she was going to be the nominee and had a pretty decent shot at becoming the first woman president to succeed the first African-American president. And then all of a sudden you have this disruptor figure who is so unorthodox in sort of the way he approached the campaign, in a way that we've had very unorthodox candidates before, but nobody who's registered his vote share in a primary, and of it certainly becoming the nominee. And so I think there was, even amongst some of his own voters, a disbelief that things, that he could actually win and beat sort of an established Hillary Clinton for the presidency. When you look back at the polling in 16, there were a couple things. Nationally, we were actually, 16 was one of the closest elections from a polling standpoint that we've ever had. There were some studies done after the fact that it was actually one of the most accurate. I think the popular vote was off by a half a percentage or a percentage point relative to her vote, to the secretary's vote share. Obviously, again, we don't have national elections. We have the Electoral College. And if you look at directionally where of the 10 most competitive states were the morning of the election, 7 of them were directionally correct. Florida, Iowa, Virginia, New Hampshire, Colorado, Nevada, Ohio, they all correctly said Donald Trump would win that state, like in Florida or Ohio, or Hillary Clinton would win, like in Colorado or Virginia. There were 3 very, very big misses which swung the election: Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And what I think happened when you look back, and what I sort of know happened, a Republican hadn't won the election, hadn't won one of those states since 1988, since George H.W. Bush, and I don't think had won Wisconsin since 1984 when Ronald Reagan won it. And so what had happened sort of each subsequent presidential election, really starting in the 90s and 2000s, is there was less polling being conducted in those states. And we really saw it, public polling, we really saw it in 2008 and 2012. I worked as deputy pollster for the Romney for President campaign in 2012, and there just weren't a lot of public polls in those three states because polls are extremely expensive. Good, you know, telephone surveys are very expensive. And so there was just sort of, you had a couple that were done and they were miscalculated. The where I think the industry has learned, and I have much better expectation for, you know, a few weeks from now, is education was a thing, was the big sort of X factor that pollsters hadn't really ever weighted to education. We have this huge education divide where the top, I think, 15 most highly educated states are all blue, and the bottom 35 most educated states are all red. And that has never been the case before the last few years. And so we, as pollsters, were waiting to party, we were waiting to age, we were waiting to things that we know exit polls typically show, or the electorate typically resembles. We weren't waiting to education. And so we missed this big chunk of non-college educated white voters who, a lot of them had voted for President Obama in 08 and 12, and then flipped to Donald Trump in 16. And there was not an adjustment for education. That's been a big correcting point in the industry over the last 4 years. And I think we actually had a pretty decent, the industry had a pretty decent showing in 18 of the statewide and gubernatorial, you know, Senate and gubernatorial races. Mm-hmm. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but I think that, you know, if I'm offering a piece of advice, it's look at averages, you know, not just one particular data point from a poll. Look at the average of polls in that state, that race, and look at trends, not just the raw ballot itself, but look at, are people kind of trending more positively towards one candidate or the other? Are they trending more negatively? What are they hearing about that candidate? You know, there are different campaigns where you're hearing more things pop up right now, and that can oftentimes be a kind of an indicator of how the ballot will follow suit.
Okay, terrific. Let's shift to healthcare. Which I don't know. I don't know if it's always a key point. I'm gonna say I don't recall healthcare being always a top issue in national presidential elections going back, you know, through the last 20 years. Let's say that I could be wrong on that, but it certainly is now and has been. 2018 included. Talk a little bit about the role healthcare is playing, just broadly speaking.
You're absolutely right. In presidential elections, it has not been a top issue. It's been a top issue in the last three midterm elections, 2010, 2014, and 2018. Probably the top issue in 2014 and 2018, and the second highest issue in 2010 after the economy. And it's interesting, it went sort of to the advantage of Republicans in 10 and in 14 over sort of the kind of outcry over the Affordable Care Act, or kind of pushback that voters had over the Affordable Care Act. And then 18, it flipped completely to the advantage of Democrats. When we came into this year, healthcare was the dominant issue of the election. And if you think back to where we were in January, you know, we had a Democratic primary taking place where you kind of had the top two or three, I guess, you know, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders were the top two or two of the top three, you know, performing candidates. And there was a conversation taking place in the Democratic Party about the future of healthcare delivery and or healthcare financing. Are we going to go to a Medicare for All system, or are we going to expand upon the Affordable Care Act? And obviously that conversation quickly changed when COVID entered the US and kind of dominated all of our lives. And then obviously the subsequent, what happened over the summer with demonstrations and protests, and healthcare kind of, you know, dipped down a little bit in the summer and as a top issue for voters. It has definitely risen back up again. Part of that is because I think people are re-engaging with the system and they're kind of feeling those high copays, high deductibles, high out-of-pocket healthcare costs. They're feeling that squeeze as they're starting to kind of re-engage. You know, I know we all shut down, and a lot of your clients shut down for, you know, a good period of time. And now as people are re-engaging, I think they're kind of feeling that squeeze on household budgets and personal finances. And then obviously the issue of the Supreme Court and the passing of Justice Ginsburg and the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett, and what that potentially could mean for the case that's on the docket to be heard after the election. And so it is now, you know, I think healthcare is probably a top two or three issue, whereas maybe a few months ago it had kind of dropped down a little bit to four or five. It's definitely on the minds of a lot of voters as they're voting today or next week or on November 3rd.
Yeah, and it just seems like, I would imagine, though, I'm interested to hear whether you've got any like data that supports this. Healthcare is always tricky because it's one of those things that's, you know, for people that don't understand how the system works or don't experience the healthcare system, the perspective on, say, healthcare finance and insurance and Medicare for All is really impacted by that dynamic. And then you have something like a pandemic where so many people theoretically are impacted by, or it's easier to see, holy cow, I could be as healthy as anybody and this thing could knock me out and I could have hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical bills, or I perceive that. It would seem to me that that would raise the profile not only of the issue, but of questioning just the system itself, how we pay for it and all that. Is that something that you guys have seen, or is that something that's reflected in this year because of the pandemic?
I don't know that voters are necessarily saying because of the pandemic that they're rethinking the system. They were already having the conversation, or they were already supporting, at least a chunk of voters were already showing support for an overhaul of the system. If you look back at kind of the support for Medicare for All numbers coming into the year, and it's a little bit of a, Medicare for All is interesting, or just healthcare policy in general. It's one of those issues where, to your point, Chris, because voters don't always have such a great grasp around it, they things in theory always sound better than when they're actually put on the floor of the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House or to the Oval Office, the Resolute Desk, to be signed. What I mean by that is you sort of see this elevation. You know, we saw it in 2008 with healthcare reform, and then we barely got healthcare reform over the goal line. And obviously, you know, Ted Kennedy passing made sort of a last minute, they were able to get it through at the last minute, but and that was with 60 senators in the U.S., you know, down to 59 after Kennedy, but in dominant control of the U.S. House. And so I think healthcare is one of those things, unlike some other issues where people have a little bit better grasp, healthcare is sort of a pie in the sky issue where people in theory often support something, an overhaul or change. And then when you kind of give them more information, sometimes you'll see voters, at least a chunk of voters pull back. So, but there is sort of a baseline of we spend too much money. I personally spend too much money as a voter. That's what we hear a lot of, you know, I continue to pay more and more in premiums. I continue to pay, my deductible is $3,000. I can't meet $3,000 deductible. You hear a lot of that from voters. And so I think there is sort of we need to do something different for a solid chunk of the population. I think with the pandemic, voters who are sort of looking at the pandemic as a catalyst for the need to overhaul the system, those voters sort of are the same kind of person. If you're somebody that is voting based on the pandemic and the performance of the administration or performance of any elected official, you're likely thinking about the healthcare system too. If you're looking at the pandemic as we are seeing with a lot of voters, it's not that big of a deal. We need to get back the economy going, you know, those sort of things. We can't shut down the country. You're not thinking about healthcare, or you're more inclined to probably be in opposition to some of those kind of healthcare overhauls, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That totally makes sense. Do you want to speak a little bit more about the case in front of the Supreme Court? I know you mentioned it, that is becoming more, it's being brought more to the forefront, I think, obviously because of, the Supreme Court situation right now. And I think from what I've heard, the Democrats are really trying to use that as their primary message, as they go into the Supreme Court nomination hearings.
Democrats won big the House in 2018. They, I think, overperformed. I think the sort of consensus going in was 30 seat pickup. I think they picked up 38 or 4, I can't remember now, but they overperformed expectations. And a lot of it centered around pre-existing conditions, or protecting, you know, folks who have pre-existing conditions, protecting that health insurance coverage and kind of the essential component of the ACA for a lot of folks. And the most popular provision of the ACA. There are a lot of provisions of the ACA that aren't as popular. That is popular, and that cuts across party lines. Yeah. And so I think when you had the attempt by Republicans to repeal ACA, which they had campaigned on in 2010, 2012, 2014, 2016, so there was kind of you've campaigned on it so long, you have to do something. They just obviously, you know, Senator McCain, voted against, and it fell apart. And I think Republicans, that having a piece of legislation get that close and then not get through, you're going to have backlash. You're always going to have backlash with voters for trying to repeal it, but you are going to have backlash if you can't even put forth your, when you control the government. But the election in 2018, the by far the dominant message in advertising across the country was healthcare. You know, Democrats kind of pushing this narrative that Republicans want to take away your pre-existing condition coverage, and it worked. And that was the top issue of the 2018 midterms, and that it went decisively. Voters who voted on healthcare went decisively for Democrats, and Democrats didn't really have that. You know, before a month ago, you know, when we, early September, Democrats didn't have that. The case was always there, but the Supreme Court justices, minus the you know, Scalia and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and I can't remember who Gorsuch replaced now, but
Alito.
Yeah, yeah. And so Alito, so, yeah.
He's still there, yeah.
Yeah. But so the ideological composition of the Supreme Court was the same. And so I think people sort of, you know, it had been litigated in 2012. It had been litigated again in 2000, I think, was it 16, when it went back in front of the court. And so I think voters, it was there, but voters weren't as concerned. And then you have the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and it changed the paradigm on healthcare. And I think Democrats have seen that quickly saw that as whoever they're going to nominate is likely going to be very conservative and may rule against this case or rule in favor of the Texas AG and the 22 plaintiffs. And so it has, what you've seen in the last few weeks, because I know you probably have a lot of clients and folks that are listening that are not in swing states, that aren't really seeing the messages that are coming through in campaign ads. What you've seen is this exponential growth in the healthcare messages from Democrats in key Senate races, in key presidential battleground states, because they know that it is a playbook that worked incredibly well for them in 2018, and nothing's really changed to make it not work again. And so I think that's something that has kind of, I think, put some Republicans on their heels in some races, because there has no, you know, there's not, they don't really have a good counter for that. And so I think it's right now, I think it's, you're seeing it to the advantage of Democrats.
Yeah. Even to your point, I just, you know, because here in Minnesota, I guess we're considered a swing state. We're a state in play or something. Get lots of political direct mail. And just yesterday or the other day, received a postcard that was anti the Republican candidate for the state house, not even like U.S. House. And, you know, it didn't say anything about the Democrat who was running, was all anti. And the number one thing was she's against providing pre-existing conditions or coverage. And so I just found that really interesting. Like she's not even going to be able to influence that, to my understanding, but it's still the number one message against her as a state candidate. So
it is. And when you look back, coming into the year, I think Republicans probably had the leg up on the issue of healthcare, because when you kind of peel back the onion a little bit on the Medicare for All conversation, voters were not in favor of Medicare for All. The term itself is sort of, you know, it derives a positive connotation. You know, Medicare is a good thing. We all sort of think Medicare, we all know Medicare mm-hmm. is a good thing. And yeah, everyone should have that. But when you kind of then inform, when voters learned, oh, but it, you know, the particular provision or plan that's been put out by Senator Sanders says we're going to eliminate all private coverage, including employer provided coverage. While people like to complain, and I hear this in focus groups all the time, they like to complain about, and with for good reason, with some of the deductibles that insurers have issued or kind of continue to raise, but they very much like to sort of complain about their plan and vent and talk about all the problems and the cost sharing and that sort of thing. But then you sort of put that question in front of them, well, what if we just took that away or ended that, and you just went on to a plan that everyone in the country had? And there's sort of a, wait, don't touch my healthcare, don't touch my plan. And so when you have 170 million Americans that have covered, well, at least pre-COVID, had coverage through employer provided and, you know, their employer, you Republicans actually, for the first time since probably 2014, had a leg up on the healthcare issue. And then the pandemic hits, and then far more than the pandemic is the sort of realignment that I think we're going to see of the Supreme Court and what that could mean. there are other issues that the Supreme Court carries when it comes to healthcare. Obviously, there's issues around contraception and abortion, those types of things. But for now, it's really, Democrats are really kind of driving home the pre-existing coverage piece, to your point, when you're seeing it at a state ledge level.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think let's talk a little bit here about hospitals and health systems specifically, because while I think pre-existing conditions is something that, you know, maybe on the periphery impacts them, I would imagine, and maybe you have polling on this or not, when there's blame to be given, like if you get a health care bill and it's like, well, you're not covered for this because you had a pre-existing condition. I don't know if anybody deals with that anymore. When they did, that blame would probably be assigned to the insurer, not the provider, right? So it's less of an issue for providers, but there are plenty of issues. You mentioned a couple. Let's focus on three. Obviously, looking for some financial support because of the you know, the devastation financially from COVID. So the stimulus package is one. I know you want to talk a little bit about surprise billing and then even vaccines. Maybe talk about it through the context of maybe a month from now when we know who won, whether it's Biden or Trump, what the impact could be on each of those topics given either outcome.
Well, let me go back to one thing real quick on COVID. Mm-hmm. I won't spend a lot of time on COVID itself and the impact of the election. It's definitely an issue that is to the advantage of Democrats. We talked about earlier when you asked about, you know, the impact of the president contracting COVID and being hospitalized. It's definitely an issue that is if you're voting on COVID, you're almost certainly voting for Joe Biden or the Democratic Senate candidate or the Democratic congressional candidate down, you know, and so on. But the one interesting thing to keep an eye on with COVID itself is more of a mechanical issue, I should say. That's not the right word, but that's the impact on voting. One of the things that we've seen in the last 3 weeks is the massive advantage that Democrats have on early mail-in voting around the country. Democrats always have an advantage on Republicans. Democrats are typically kind of, they vote earlier. They, you know, states like Colorado and Arizona, where you have a high percentage of the electorate that votes by mail and has pre-COVID, it's always sort of to the advantage of the Democrat and Republicans make up ground on election day. But Democrats are building some huge leads in places like Pennsylvania and Florida on early voting. And I think what's interesting to me about that is, you know, you have a situation where we don't know what November 3rd looks like in the country with respect to COVID. We don't know where there could be outbreaks. And if you're thinking about kind of a tactical standpoint, you know, if you're 70 years old and you have voted in the same fire station for 25 years and you show up on election morning and because of COVID, the county has, or the precinct has consolidated down into two or three places as opposed to six or whatever that we're seeing, because each state runs its own kind of election. There's a little bit of a gamble, not gamble is not the right word, but there's a little bit of a risk, I think, mm-hmm. for Republicans in that the mail-in issue could come back on them if we see some outbreaks, particularly in some of these battleground states where they're really banking on the election day voters themselves. Or if you show up and your precinct has been consolidated down to three polling places and the line is 2 hours and you're like, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to stand in line.
You're kind of describing Wisconsin right now, which is having a terrific outbreak. And just yesterday or the day before announced a consolidation of polling places in Milwaukee.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, we're still a month away, but that's, I don't know that that's going to get any better.
Right. In the next weeks. And so I think that's, Democrats have been pushing really hard on the mail-in and the early voting. And they are going to obviously have a lead going into election day. Republicans have been trying to, you know, banking on catching up, you know, and then potentially surpassing them if they're going to win. But it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, particularly as, you know, a month from now, it's going to be colder around the country and we'll see where we are with COVID. But then back to your question, I think three things that I think are that I'm paying attention to, irrespective of who wins the presidential election, as it relates to providers. I think the first one is the stimulus package. I mean, there's going to be another one, regardless of who wins. if Joe Biden wins, it may not come until January 21st or 22nd. You know, it may not come in the lame duck period. If Donald Trump wins, it may come a little bit more quickly, but there's going to be another package, and I think it's going to be fairly sizable. I think providers have to continue to advocate for the relief funding. I know the AHA has been leading the charge on the additional $100 billion. I think each, you know, it's incumbent upon providers to continue to make that case towards their legislators, their members of Congress, their senators, and reminding them that voters, of more than anybody else, voters view their workers, the nurses, the doctors, the frontline healthcare workers, as the ultimate heroes of COVID. And, you know, we saw polling, you know, we did over the summer where we had 76% of Americans supporting the additional $100 billion for hospitals, including a majority of Republicans who are typically a little bit supposedly more fiscally conservative. And so I think that's a important thing to continue to remind those legislators that, hey, you know, we are the ones that have been showing up day and night, 24/7, 365 through the thick and thin of this. And, you know, we need continued relief funding. I think the second thing is surprise billing. I think we're certainly going to see, we're not done with surprise billing. It's shelved, I think, till post-election, but I think surprise billing is going to come roaring back either in the lame duck or in 2021. And I think we actually did a survey on this a couple of weeks ago in six target Senate states on the provider side of this issue. We've done a lot of work on the provider side of this issue, and voters are overwhelmingly in support of providers on surprise billing, but less, more so kind of framing it as, you know, we should support the interests of doctors and nurses and hospitals over health insurance companies. We trust doctors and hospitals and nurses much more than health insurers. We believe that they have our best healthcare interests in mind to look out for our family when it comes to healthcare than health insurers do. And when you kind of frame it as who should be the ones setting their payment, doctors by mile, who should, you know, and then you get into kind of the actual kind of policy merit, debate on, you know, independent dispute resolution or benchmark, and you voters will move to independent dispute resolution, the provider plan, because of their support for providers and their recognition of how essential and critical they are to our healthcare system and to our country. And then the third thing is the vaccine. When we get to a place where we have a vaccine that's been approved by the FDA, seems likely in the first part of next year, maybe first quarter, first half, you know, well, we all have our fingers crossed that we get there sooner, but, you know, whenever we get there, I think providers are going to have to play a very large role on this topic. I think just some of the research that we've done, you sort of see the concerns that people have with being kind of first in line or even second in line, sort of the mindset that I want to wait a year and see what happens. I'm not going to take this because I don't think COVID seriously. I'm not going to take this because the government can't tell me what to do. I'm not going to take this because I'm scared of side effects, or I don't want to, you know, I have a pre-existing condition and I don't know what, nobody really knows what that'll do. These companies have developed it so fast. We don't really know the long-term effects of the vaccine. There's just so much angst and concern that voters and, or I should say Americans, talk about. And when you get into who do you trust the most, it's what it's been throughout COVID, which is healthcare workers, frontline healthcare professionals, nurses, doctors, hospitals. And there's just this, you know, my doctor recommending me, but also, you know, healthcare workers taking it. And I know that's a whole issue in and of itself. But I think providers are going to have to play a large role if we are going to have some sort of mass scale vaccine, you know, adoption or administration. I think providers are going to have to kind of be center to that effort.
Yeah, it's just going to be so difficult. Such a difficult situation. I mean, obviously coming into this year, the idea of not trusting vaccines was seen as a very outlying position, though garnered a lot of attention, obviously. Now it's just like a free for all. Now, we just heard it last night in the debate where you have the VP candidate on the Democrat side saying, if it's President Trump telling me to take this, I'm not taking it. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of people that feel that way. It just, it's become so politicized. And I think the issue for providers is, you know, in the beginning of COVID, a lot of them sat too much on the sidelines, not taking advantage of the trust that you're talking about, and just said, hey, this is the CDC's territory. We're not going to touch that. Well, now, A, I don't think you should do that because you are seen as the trusted resource, but B, the even the CDC's position is not going to be trusted, because we keep seeing almost on a daily basis, if not weekly, stories about pressure being put on by, you know, the administration to loosen the rules and make sure we can get something by election. And, you know, what I think is interesting, and maybe you can speak to this, is there really a belief that if there somehow was a vaccine push before election day, that that would make a difference in the election at this point?
Even it could help, I think, on the margins, but I think we've seen so much erosion in willingness to take the vaccine since going back to kind of April when we first started asking this question, that I don't know that it has that big of an impact. And I actually think the president came out in the last day or two and said, and I have to go back and look at this, but I thought I read that he said he acknowledged that there wouldn't be a vaccine actually ready by election day. So that conversation, I mean, I think that would require the FDA ending a clinical trial before it was scheduled to end, which I don't think happens very often. And so I sort of have been agnostic to the whole vaccine before the election conversation, and more so, you know, just from conversations around the industry of it's more realistic to have one, you know, approved, you know, end of the year, like December, or more likely first quarter. And then the issue of actual production and distribution, and that's a whole nother issue. But no, I mean, Chris, I think it's a really good point. I think you have seen some erosion in trust towards the CDC. You've seen some erosion in trust towards the FDA. And I'll tell you what happens if Joe Biden wins the presidency, that's going to flip. Those numbers aren't going to suddenly change. What will happen is the Democrats who won't take the vaccine when Donald Trump tells them to take it, or have lost some trust in the CDC or FDA, it will flip to Republicans are not going to take it because, you know, when Joe Biden tells them to take it, or not tells them, but, you know, suggest they take it, and Republicans are not going to trust the CDC and the FDA under a Biden administration. So again, I think that kind of brings back this sort of healthcare, you know, healthcare provider kind of being central to this role. And I'll leave kind of final thing I'll say on the vaccine is one thing that we've seen in our data is unprecedented levels of voters around the country paying attention or telling us that they've seen, read, or heard a lot about hospital systems in the last few months. It's probably intuitive to a lot of people, to a lot of your clients who, you know, we all have been talking about healthcare providers and hospitals, you know, in context of COVID. But what I also look at that as is an opportunity for providers to have a platform in probably a way that they've never had before. Mm-hmm. I know there's paid media efforts and sort of the branding things and new service lines and a lot of marketing work that goes into attracting patients and talking about the experience and why your, you know, organization offers better care delivery. But I think just sort of earned media perspective, I think there's a platform that hospital systems have right now that, and it's a short shelf life. I don't know when the shelf life is, but at least right now voters are still paying attention to kind of things that are coming from hospital systems in their communities and regions.
Well, I don't know how short the shelf life really is. I mean, I think you bring up a really good point that, you know, we're talking about the dissolving trust of government institutions that for until this point, you know, attained a lot of high level of trust in this country, and that's not going to change. It'll just flip. So, I mean, providers need to be thinking about, hey, it's not like on November 4th, all of a sudden we can sit back and let the CDC take over again. Not only will it flip, how permanent the damage could be. I mean, until we get to a place where we're not so segregated in terms of our thinking and so red and blue, which I don't know when the heck that is, these resources that typically hospitals and health systems could point to and rely on as, well, we're just going to follow them, that's going to be in question for a while. It could be years. And that's a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
In terms of everything from vaccines to another outbreak of a, you know, a disease to whatever it might be. That's something that from a strategic standpoint needs a lot of thought.
No, I think that's I think that's exactly right.
Just so folks know, by the way, if you have questions for Jarrett, for myself, for Chase, put them in the Q&A. We've got one I'm going to ask you about here in a second. Chase is also in the chat function, posted a link to some content that we pulled together on how hospitals need to think about 10 things they need to think about in terms of the vaccine. So it goes a little bit more into depth in that. One of the questions that came up was, for the first time, I think I've seen this, maybe this has happened before, but I've been in the industry a long time and I don't remember seeing it before. Hospitals and health systems going out with public messages, encouraging people to vote. You know, it's that something that, you know, I don't know what the impact is on folks, but, you know, talk a little bit to that. Is that, do you think that's advocacy that's here to stay? Or is it more because of some of the things we've been talking about, like the need for stimulus and the, I don't think the advocacy for voting is, from what I've seen, pushing people to vote one way or the other. It's just voting.
Right.
But I don't know if you've got a perspective on that.
I think, in terms of the, you know, push advocacy for people to vote or pushing for people to vote, we don't see backlash to that. I think you see backlash when it's from an organization that has a political interest, like a trade group or maybe not a trade group, but has kind of a, they align with one party or the other and they're saying you should go vote. But if it's, you know, people don't view hospitals as partisan. You know, maybe there are some cases here and there, but as a whole, they're viewed as independent, you know, healthcare professionals and institutions, which is exactly what they are. Certainly the people that make them up have leanings one way or the mm-hmm. other, but people don't view, I think, the healthcare industry, you know, there's so much, it's kind of like, you know, we have a few institutions as a country that we still have a lot of trust in, military, you know, I think teachers, but healthcare professionals are certainly at the top of the list. We always see nurses every single year at the top of Gallup's most trusted profession list. I think it's pretty much consecutive year over year for 10 or 15 years running. And so I think the issue of having health systems and provider organizations, you know, get people involved and say, go vote. I don't think there's backlash. I don't know if it stays or not. I don't know if this year is so, because we've been having this entire conversation around injustice, because we've been all kind of put into this unbelievably, you know, unprecedented position, at least in our lifetimes, of COVID and how it's impacted us, you know, personally and families and just sort of these society and the economy. I don't know if it's a here to stay. I wouldn't be afraid of pushing it. You know, I think, you know, you look at kind of the depressing turnout that we see in midterms, where we have, you know, 70% of voters or 75% of registered voters in the U.S. turn out in the presidential, and then it drops down to 45 or 48% in midterms. You know, I think that's not a good thing for our democracy. And so I think I wouldn't be afraid of it, but I think, you know, just being cognizant that there are organizations that have probably had some backlash because they've been perceived as taking a position prior to the vote. But it's a really good question, because you're right. You are seeing a lot more of it, healthcare organizations, but also just a lot of organizations in general. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we can leave it with this too, going back to what you brought up, which I think is so important to remember. Like, election day is not going to solve this problem of trust in institutions that typically had it. It's just going to flip it. And to what degree could that impact hospitals and health systems, where if they are now supporting, let's say, a vaccine in December or January, will people call that out as political? You know, I think of sports, I think of the NBA, I think of the NFL, which used to avoid political stances like the plague, and more recently have been much more outward in supporting like social justice issues. And there's been backlash to that. Now, I don't know how much that's really impacted the brand of the NBA or the NFL or their finances. But I think of something similar that could happen and something that hospitals and health systems should consider. It doesn't mean they shouldn't support a vaccine if they believe it's the right thing. It's just that kind of thing may become politicized down the road.
I do think you're right. And I think there's a do as I do, not as I say element, I think, that we've been seeing in our research, where people, it's not just enough to say my doctor telling me or recommending I take the vaccine. It's knowing that my doctor and my, you know, the employees of my healthcare system have taken the vaccine would increase my confidence significantly in taking it, because if they're doing it, then, you know, you're still going to have a chunk of people that are never going to take it. You're going to have a chunk of people that are going to probably wait a year or so. And there are reasons. I mean, the politicalization of COVID is a big reason, but there are a lot of other reasons on the vaccine itself. It's not quite the same as masking. There are a lot of other reasons on the vaccine itself. You talked about kind of the anti-vaxxer and kind of just vaccines in general. We have seen kind of coming into this year some erosion in the percent of Americans who think wellness vaccines are very important. You know, it's not, we still, I think, have 70 to 75% of Americans who believe those are very important, but it's down 10 or 15 points from 2000. And so there's been some erosion in attitudes towards wellness vaccines. And then you get into kind of some different population groups, rural Americans, minority Americans, Americans with younger children. These are groups that sort of are showing more resistance to the vaccine or taking the vaccine. And it's not necessarily in the context of the politicalization. That's certainly going to be there. And for some of those people, they're just never going to take it. But for others, it's sort of fear and the concern. And I think that's where healthcare providers can play that role. But again, I think you're right, Chris. There's a little bit of a slippery slope. And I think people are going to be looking to see, is this hospital or hospital system, are their employees taking the vaccine? And again, I know that brings a whole other set of issues up for healthcare providers. But I think when they see that, for the folks that are sort of on the fence or kind of somewhat in opposition to doing it, I think you build confidence in those folks by seeing that.
Yeah. And I'll just add one last point here. A focus group of one, but I think it speaks to the complexity of that very issue, Jarrett, which is we've done some research on our own about this. And somebody relayed to me discussion with the nurse, and the question was, emergency room nurse, who do you think should receive the vaccine first? And the answer was healthcare workers, frontline workers. And then the question was, do you want to be the first to take the vaccine? And she said, I'd actually like to be in the second or third wave. Yeah. So while an organization may have a stance and a POV, if your doctor is like, yeah, I know what they're saying, but what I would tell you is wait, that's the kind of thing that hospital health systems are going to have to deal with, because it does get down to that level, to the individual level.
You're absolutely right. It's going to be complicated. I think it's going to be extremely complicated and messy. And I think I'm probably simplifying it a little bit, but I think you're right. There are going to be a host of issues. But again, I do come back to, I think in order for there to be a widespread adoption over a year or 18 months or however long the period is, providers are going to have to probably play more of a role than maybe they are thinking right now. But you're right. There are a host of issues, the complications and complexities that come along with, it's not as simple as just saying you should take the vaccine because I'm telling you or because our people are taking it. Yeah,
100%. So hopefully hospitals and health systems will step into that role. Again, look at the link that we provided. That's part of what we're advocating for our clients to do. Good place to wrap, Jarrett. As always, it's so great having you. Trying to decide if we want to have you back right before the election. It's scary. I just want this to be over. I bet like if you polled people, like 95% of the people be like, can this just be over?
Well, I mean, you and I talked about this last week where, and that was pre-admission to the president's admission to Walter Reed, right. But just the amount of things that have happened. We've already had 3 October surprises and it's October 8th. And the idea that we're not going to have something else happen between now and election day is very improbable just given the pace at which we have these types of events occur. Who knows what we have ahead of us in the next 3.5 weeks before election day.
Oh man, I don't even want to imagine what those would be. But thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate it. This is a great discussion.
Absolutely. Really appreciate it, Chris and Chase, and always really enjoy the chance to talk with you guys.
Yeah, for sure. Chase, thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Enjoyed it as well.
If you've got something you want us to cover, let us know. You can post something in the chat channel right now. You can email us at nonormal@thinkrevivehealth.com. Next week, we're going to have Matt Pinzer, who is Chief Marketing Officer at Jackson Health System in Miami, Florida, join us. Remember to visit thinkrevivehealth.com/COVID-19 for a recording of today's episode. or check us out on iTunes or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. And until next week, good luck out there in the no normal. Thanks for joining us.